Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, May 5th, 2022. On tonight's show, my guests, Debbie Friedman and Ali Broomer of Contact Theater present Next to Normal.
I find often when we talk and when society talks about mental health, it's almost in a singular sort of tone. You know, if you're suffering or if someone in your family is suffering, but we don't really talk about the ripple effects that it has and the fact that you're not just suffering from mental illness in a silo. Share breath together, to share some gratefulness together. That was kind of our regular closure practice. And I think it really helped just kind of create a nice division between your character and yourself. That's kind of the main role of closure practices, is having that clear division so you're not carrying kind of the weight of all these characters' lives with you when you also have the weight of your own life.
Jason Grimmer and James McGee on a new venue for comedy in the Mile End.
Over the time of the pandemic, when there was a interim, when there were no improv classes being offered, I started offering them at Variations, which then blossomed into a full-fledged kind of improv stream at the school, turning into more of a performance school as opposed to only a dance school.
Well, I would say that Mr. Bryan Adams said it best when he said he just couldn't stand another lonely night. And I think there is no better way, and I mean this from my heart of hearts, to find ways to connect with people on a level that is both educational as well as fun and energetic. Take an improv class.
And choreographer Simon Portugal questions our relationship with the online world.
So I think they're shaping our sociality, how we are together. And I wanted to, think about that through formal structures on stage together, sort of turning the algorithm into like a shape.
Before we begin, some updates. Listen, there is so much theater to see here in Montreal this week. It's an embarrassment of riches. Miranda Rose Hall's A Play for the Living in a Time of Extinction is now open at Centaur Theater. I saw the opening last Friday and I loved it. It feels like an episode of Nova or Radiolab presented on stage, with dips into science and geography, but it's also searing, a meditation on life and what's truly worth living and fighting for. As you may recall on this show, Miranda told us that she sets the scene with Naomi, a theater manager on the final night of a play tour, but her actors are missing. So she musters up all she's read, digested, and pondered about the very existence of our human lives, as well as the ongoing fight for climate change, and what are we doing to the planet? If you're wondering whether we as a society can slow down our consumption and do better for the planet and ourselves, you'll love the show. It's on at Centaur now, centaurtheater.com. Also opening tonight, April Fool's, a rock star who decides to embark on an affair, even though she's got kids and a husband waiting at home. Would you take the risk for love if you might lose it all? That's at the Siegel Center starting tonight, siegelcenter.org. Also, Mazel Tov by Infinitheater. It's about an interfaith wedding where punches are pulled, and it's been selling out. So you want to run to see if you can get tickets before the end of the run. Visit infinitheater.com. And yesterday, the interim public health director of Quebec announced that you will no longer need to mask in public starting on Saturday, May 14th. And this is the first time the mask mandate has been lifted since July 2020. There are some exceptions, like in healthcare settings and on public transit. But will theaters still ask audiences to keep their masks on for now? We'll see soon enough. Will you want to keep your mask on when you're in the audience? While Dr. Belot does point out that we seem to be over the sixth wave of COVID, a lot of experts are warning that it's a good idea to keep your masks on just to be super safe, especially for individuals who are immunocompromised and don't really have a lot of choice in the matter. Now, on with our show. Diana Goodman is a mom in suburbia, waiting up late for a son who has broken curfew and also supervising a daughter who is studying for a big test. But over the course of the night and into the next morning, we realize something is amiss in this picture of a suburban family. Diana has bipolar. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional student and community productions in and around Montreal, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah De A, recording from home on Thursday, May 12th, 2022. On tonight's show, my guest, Travis Knights, is an ambassador of the hidden history of jazz and tap and black artists, but insists that at the end of the day, he sees his job as pretty straightforward. Talisman Theatre goes virtual again with the translation of Night from the 4th to the 5th, the story of a sexual assault told through several viewpoints. Actress Naka Bertrand. And joining us as well is stage manager Bertie Gregor, who was asked to pinch hit as the central character. And efforts to green the world of theater. Devin Hardy shares a new game plan to help companies save the planet. And on with our show. When he was a child, Travis Knights tried every group sport from soccer to hockey, or at least his parents forced him to. But Travis eventually found his way to another kind of physical activity, the world of jazz and tap. The Montrealer studied under legendary teacher Ethel Bruno, who has trained more than one generation of dancers and is seen as an icon in Montreal, but also the larger tap community. But Travis seeks more than just to perform and to entertain. He is passionate about sharing the incontrovertible Black history of the dance form, from origins as a form of communication in the South, to vaudeville halls, to Hollywood screens, to today, even if he has to push back on the idea that tap might be passé. Travis centers his practice as a Black performance art, taking a non-Eurocentric lens and exploring the tangibility of dance tradition, hence his new show title, Ephemeral Artifacts, the idea that dance is here and now, but also lasts within you forever. Travis is getting ready to perform this new show presented by Anundam Company at the Mai starting tonight until Saturday. And there's a very special addition to the show to make it accessible to deaf and hard of hearing audience members. Travis has performed on four continents. He's danced at the 2010 Winter Olympic Games opening ceremony in Vancouver, and he also won the 2020 Jacqueline Lemieux Prize for Outstanding Contribution to Dance in Canada. Travis Knights is an incredible storyteller, and I hope you enjoy hearing this interview as much as I loved speaking with him. I talked with Travis yesterday. Welcome to Upstage, Travis. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to say this, we're on Zoom right now. I'm seeing you. You're wearing your beautiful red button-up shirt. And there's a shoe, your left hand, my right hand corner, right in front of the frame. And it's a tap shoe.
And never leave home without them. That's the very first thing my teacher Ethel Bruno taught me. You know, as soon as you learn how to shake, we're getting started. It's an interesting part of the negotiation.
Why is it important to always have a pair of shoes with you? Is it because you never want to pass up an opportunity, or is it more about just always being, you know, ready to perform? Or
fantastic. It's like it's a lifestyle, you know. I am a tap dancer. Like I'm not even joking. People, producers that I talk with a lot, think that they laugh. that's cute. But I want to reduce my bio to just say Travis Knights is a tap dancer. Period. All of the other stuff that's great, and I've done a lot. I've traveled the world. I've lived here and there. I've toured. It's all great. I've been blessed. Fantastic. But at the beginning and the end of every day, what it all boils down to is the dance itself, and everything else is cute.
Everything else is gravy.
Yeah. There you go. That's better. Yeah.
This is so funny to me because I'm always under the impression that the longer your bio is, the better, the more projects you tack on, the more things you've done, you know, but for you, it's all about one word.
Yeah. Tap dance. I feel like the dance is its own high praise, high art. It's its own thing. And let's not mince words here. I don't want to give the impression that I am not impressed with people's bios. I don't want to give the impression like I don't become like the biggest fanboy for like specific people that I put up on pedestals. And it's related to what I've seen them do. It's related to this history that I've built up with them. But when it comes to tap dance, people rarely see it. You know, And I kind of enjoy the opportunity to come in completely bare and give you a first impression beyond film and television, a first impression of what live tap dance is. Yeah, I love that experience for audiences.
We'll get into the first impressions you're giving out in this incredible show in just a moment. But you mentioned Ethel Bruno, who is a teacher of yours. And that's where I wanted to start your journey to tap and to dance. And consequently, you coming across Ethel. Tell me about that.
I don't think I had a choice in the matter. I really believe that like the dance chose me. So at the time, I'm like 9 years old. I'm 8 years old and I'm socially inept. I've got no skills. I don't understand people. And quite frankly, I'm afraid of them. And so my parents wisely said, oh, you know, this is a problem. We're social animals. We should, team sports. So they put me in hockey, horrible. Baseball, marginally better, but still horrible. And then I saw Gregory Hines performing on stage. He was, at the time, he was doing a tribute to Sammy Davis Jr., who was, Sammy was sick at the time, he was dying of cancer. And all of Hollywood came out, like Eddie Murphy hosted the show, Stevie Wonder was on the gig, Michael Jackson was on the gig. Then here comes Gregory Hines doing something that I've seen before, but not like that, not like that. So he did this amazing impassioned speech telling Sammy how much he appreciated him, how much he means, how much influence, and then he tap dances, phenomenal. But then, this at the time he was very very small. He lost a lot of weight, Sammy, but he put on his tap shoes, and it's like all of the sickness disappeared. He went up on stage, and they communicated together, tapathetically speaking. They had like a rhythm exchange, and I was sold. Right away, I went to my parents. Next year was going to be soccer. Nah, please. Please, please, tap dance. And it's another miracle that I got hooked up with Ethel Bruno, who's originally from Harlem, New York. And you have to understand that tap dance is a Black cultural art form, and it was like a central element to the Harlem Renaissance in terms of the artists and the explosion of culture then. And so to be taught from Ethel Bruno, a daughter of the Harlem Renaissance, it just like, I had no choice. It's from that point when I'm 10 years old to speaking to you right now, it's just a straight line of passion and hardcore geekdom on foot-based percussive rhythm. Yeah.
You see yourself as a direct inheritance, like that you're keeping alive a seed from the Harlem Renaissance, you know, from Ethel to you onto whoever you're teaching next. Like, is that real for you?
Absolutely. It's real. It's important. And it's the reason why, you know, coming back to that bio conversation, like everything else is kind of noise. Tap dance benefits from being hyper popular back in the day, but it also suffers from being hyper popular back in the day, because you know during the Harlem Renaissance you had Black people moving from the South to the North during the Great Migration, and they're taking you know the rhythms that are coming from New Orleans. Is mixing with what's happening in Kansas City, Chicago, and then they land, some of them, a critical mass, land in Harlem. And you have these different cultures of people, all of them considered Black, right? But they have these different cultures of people mixing together. You have musicians and singers and dancers and poets and visual artists mixing together. And that scene, the culture that was formed, exploded all over the world. It's called jazz, right? And so for me, it's more than, for me, I think show business is a distraction, right? It's a way to commodify what I've dedicated my life to, but the culture is what gives life. The culture is what inspired people to come in and be tourists in Harlem and then take the choreography that they learned and put it on Hollywood screens. The culture is at risk of dying, right? I'm one of only a handful of Black tap dancers in Canada, period. And that there's a lot of reasons for that, but I do consider it a part of my mission, a part of my journey to help rectify that, to reintroduce tap dance to the Black community here in Canada and around the world.
That is the voice of Travis Knights, who is a dancer, first and foremost, but also a creator as well, presenting Ephemeral Artifacts, Travis Knight, by his company Anundam at the Mai this week. And it's so funny that you're touching on all of this and talking about, you know, the commodification of a dance form, but also how it gets transmitted to a larger community. But at the same time, you're saying it's at risk. The title of your show, Ephemeral Artifacts, points out the fact that, you know, being on stage, it is ephemeral. It is in the moment. So maybe we can get into the show itself by pointing to these two words, ephemeral artifacts, and elaborating a little bit more there.
Yeah, I love it. It's an oxymoron that I really enjoy. Ephemeral, here today, meaning here today, gone tomorrow, basically. Artifact, here, period. It's linked to history. The tap dance, as it was taught to me, is very much a part of an oral tradition, which means it's just passed on from one person to another. I have a drop. So hold on, let's back up. What I'm saying right now about tap dance is largely informed by hip hop, right? Hip hop, in terms of the birth of it, has been well documented, and it is also hyper popular, and in terms of the music, it's gone all over the world. And so I see tap dance as a cautionary tale for people that currently enjoy hip hop. You know, it's been commodified. It's not necessarily in that community anymore, in the community that birthed it. It's global. It's a global culture for those who choose to engage with it as a culture. But the values that are in hip hop are very similar to the values that were in jazz culture back at the Harlem Renaissance. And so in terms of the responsibility I feel to sharing this thing, it's all over the show. You know, Ephemeral Artifacts is a way for me to share the value system of this form, of this culture. People say, you know, tap dance, what? You're a tap dancer? What does that mean? What do you do? I'm about to explain it this weekend in a way that hopefully is wholesome, you know, fulfilling, and clear.
That is the voice of Travis Knights, who's, as he's saying, about to present something pretty spectacular this weekend. You mentioned that the art form is at risk. You mentioned just now someone saying to you, you're a tap dancer. What is that? Yeah. Why is it at risk? Is it because the form has been superseded by other forms, or is it a matter of trends? How do you see that? You said it was a complicated answer. So
yeah, complicated answer.
Yeah.
So like, I'm going to attack. Look at me. I'm in my B-boy stance right now. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to attack the idea of trends first. So with trends, now we're linked to the economy. We're linked to the market. And, you know, trends come and they go. But when something is a cultural expression, then it's actually important to the way a culture operates, to the value systems of a person, of a human being. It's a longer answer. The dance is at risk because it has a complicated history. Let's do the Coles notes. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be long-winded. Okay. 1739, in the Carolinas, there was a rebellion. It's called the Stono Rebellion. And the Africans used drums to communicate across plantations to say, now's the time. And they, you know, they killed the masters, and they went from plantation to plantation to plantation. Eventually, that rebellion was squashed. The next year, 1740, they passed something called the Negro Act, which restricted, banned the use of drums in that particular region of what was then still the 13 colonies, right? And so what happened to those ancestral rhythms, those African rhythms, were transferred corporeally, and a form called buck dancing began. Bucks is what they called enslaved Africans back in the day, buck dancing. Buck dancing became, over time, known as buck and wing dancing. And then buck and wing became, bam, tap dance. Very much an African diasporic form. What happened in the beginning of the 1800s, though, is the beginning of appropriation. So you had people that went onto the plant doing. Then they blacked minstrel shows. And it was a propaganda for everybody that learned about in Germany during World War II. Minstrel shows were propaganda that lasted for 100 years toward all over the United States, Canada, Europe, among many other places. I think even Australia. So this practice has contributed greatly to the a negative aesthetic of Black people. Okay. So all this to say, you have artists like Bill Bojangles Robinson, who refuses to wear blackface, who breaks the two-color rule. That's another issue. We won't even go there, but he's a pioneer. Height of his career, Black performer in America, full stop. He, however, after he dies, civil rights movement happens. The Black Power movement happens. And even though he's not wearing blackface, he still has this minstrel aesthetic. An aesthetic of his time. And so Black people turned back, looked at Bill Bojangles Robinson and said, no, 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 and sacrificed tap dance, which at the time was already appropriated through minstrel shows, vaudeville, Hollywood television, Hollywood movies and television. So Black people just took a step back, several steps back, and transformed the culture into something else. The information wasn't necessarily lost, but it was transformed into something else. And to me, I'll say this. Today, we're in a period of reclamation. We're reclaiming what is ours. We're reclaiming culture. We're reclaiming our identity. We are writing our own stories. And so I'm going to use the word again. I do feel in my position, it is my responsibility to share this form with as many people that will take it in, but specifically Black people.
I could listen to you talk about this for hours, like in a grand like kind of thesis exploration, I swear, because you explained that in such a beautiful way that I think anybody who's seen one tap performance would be able to really understand. So I thank you for that. And I did want to ask about the show itself and this really cool function that you're making it really easy for people who are hard of hearing or deaf to experience the show. And you've been highlighting the importance of the percussive element of tap. So tell me about these vests and how you're opening up this to a new set of audience, a new audience.
I love it. So listen, to any artist out there listening, I highly recommend that you include a budget line in your grant to research accessibility for whatever community that you can think of. We were funded to do research on these vibro-tactile systems where they hook a microphone up to my shoe and the signal is sent to these vibrating pads. Think about, you know, for those of you that play Xbox or PlayStation, or, you know, you've been to the newest Marvel movie in one of those D-Box chairs. You know what I'm talking about? It's just this, it opens up a more sensory, another way to experience the dance, I'll put it that way. I'll push even further. When we did the research in Toronto with these systems, we invited a deaf and hard of hearing crowd, and the reactions were intense for me. It was intense for me. One of the participants, she said after the performance that it felt like a new sense was being opened to her. And as she was saying it, she started to tear up. A phenomenal experience. And I highly recommend for any artist listening, do it, because it opens up your audience, of course. Number one, opens up your audience and makes it more accessible, number one. But number two, for those who are not deaf or hard of hearing, it's still like a benefit. Like, it's like, whoa, like you never experienced, you never knew that this was possible until you put on the vest, until you put on the belt, until you know, it's worth it. It's worth it. It's good for everyone.
The last thing I wanted to ask you, Travis, is how many hours a day you spend practicing or performing?
So this is a hyper-personal question. So, okay, so I'll give the stock answer of, like, you know, 4 hours a day. 4 hours a day, that's the stock answer. But it doesn't shut off. It doesn't shut off. It, like, there's always something to do. I have a podcast, for example. I consider that podcast a part of my practice because I'm it's called the Tap Love Tour podcast. And I shamelessly write to other dancers and luminaries in the form that I have no business talking to. Like, yo, can we nerd out on this? And I ask these questions and they give me their answers. And then their answers inform my practice. You understand? It's just like, it never stops. The rhetoric the story that I gave you before about my mission in tap dance, there's so much to do. There's so much to think about. And just to button it, it brings us back to the misleading bio, because even though the gigs that I've been a part of are substantial and wonderful and they're cherished memories, they don't fully encapsulate my mission. But tap dance does.
Travis, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. You brought it right back to the beginning. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Travis Knights, tap and jazz dancer originally from Montreal, now based in Ontario. His show, Ephemeral Artifacts, launches tonight at the Mai with shows until Saturday. For audience members who are hard of hearing or deaf, there are vibro-tactile devices available for reservation. It's a vest that allows you to feel the tap as it happens. And if you'd like to learn more about Travis or follow his love for dance, in the podcast he mentioned, you can visit the Tap Love Tour on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And visit m-a-i.qc.ca for tickets and more information about the show this weekend. It's called Ephemeral Artifacts. And you can call 514-982-3386 for the box office. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come tonight, how do you make a green theater production? An initiative with roots in Montreal is offering new tools for sustainable performances. Rachel Graton's drama centers a young woman who lives through a sexual assault and then seeks justice for herself. But we see the story not just through her eyes and her flawed memory, but through that of her friends and family, witnesses, members of the judicial and support networks, observers, and journalists. The only viewpoint missing is that of the person who attacked her. The contemporary creation by Graton is called Night from the 4th to the 5th, and it is getting its English language premiere in a streaming presentation by Talisman Theatre, launching this next hour tonight and running until end of May. I spoke with two of the performers, Naka Bertrand and Bertie Gregor, earlier today. We started out by discussing the script and the characters. Bertie plays character 1, Naka plays character 3. As I mentioned earlier, we get to observe this event and the fallout through the viewpoints of several people who are involved. But the way the script is written, it's a bit complicated because you can't always tell which character is saying what based on the performer themselves. It gets a little tricky, but luckily there were some, let's say, ways to simplify the process for the performers during the filming. Here's Bertie Gregor.
I must admit it was complicated in rehearsal to figure out what intention is behind each line, because something that made sense for you internally on the journey you were going on in the scene previous now might, you know, be a complete 180 and you need to find your way back to that. So there's a lot less kind of clear character journeys that you're taking and more, you know, moment by moment embodying, you know, a certain point of view, which is interesting and definitely a challenge for sure.
Absolutely. Having to keep track of the different lines and the, like, I guess where you are in that moment. Naka, did you find a similar experience to Bertie in rehearsal, trying to keep track of where you were?
Well, the great thing about this particular production is that we had teleprompters, so we didn't need to memorize all the lines, but we read through the play many times, and it's about situating, but yeah, also creating the intention behind the words, because they could seem random, but the intention of the actors while delivering the lines kind of makes all the difference and makes the text resonate in a way that is powerful.
So it's less in the words themselves and it's more in how you deliver the line that kind of tells you where, like, tells the audience where your character stands.
I think that since it's a translation as well, there's that plays into it. But the words are kind of very important as well.
Okay.
The intention.
As performers, you must have been relying a lot on your director, Isabel, to guide you through this process.
Definitely. She was the major force, I think, in guiding us into speaking the words in a way that delivered the message.
Yeah, I would say in a project like this, you know, where the text isn't delineated by character, and then again, because we filmed it, so you're not starting at the beginning and making your way to an end, you're really, you know, placed in very specific situations for very specific takes. I think her vision and overall guidance is what we used as stepping stones. It was really, there was moments where that was all I was holding on to because I wasn't quite sure, you know, what was happening around me or what, you know, what the camera was seeing. And so I was just looking for, you know, her head nod and her, you know, approval and her feedback to know where I was at.
Performers in New Piece, Night from the 4th to the 5th, getting its official online premiere tonight. And joining us as well is Naka Bertrand, who's playing the role of character number 3 in the performance. How did you feel about the teleprompter, Bertie? Naka told us about how when you were recording, you'd have this teleprompter that you could rely on, which is not usually something you have during a live performance. Was that helpful?
The teleprompters were my lifeline. I actually didn't have any rehearsal for this piece. I was originally the production stage manager. And on the first day of filming, we found out that our lead, Rebecca Gibeon, was unable to join us in this lovely pandemic world that we were all trying to make it through. And so I was very much a pitch hitter. Those teleprompters, I would not have been able to do this production without teleprompters, without the lovely support of the rest of the cast behind me, without all of the technicians waving at me where to walk, without the lovely costume designers and props designers, you know, putting clothes on me and handing me things and telling me where to stand. All of that was essential.
What was that like for you? Because you have been working so much behind the scenes during your career, but you did study theater, you were on stage, I believe more as in your student years, right? And here you are just stepping into the main role. That must have been quite the challenge.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely felt a little bit like a fever dream. I had just come in off another production where I was working, you know, 12-hour days and didn't have any time in between. And like I said, I found out that I would be playing the role like the morning that we showed up on the first filming day. So it was a wild ride. I still kind of like, I barely remember it. Like, did it happen? You know, it was a lot, but it was fun. It was definitely, you know, I never really thought that I would go back to acting. It's not something that I'm necessarily drawn to as much as the other aspects in production, but it really surprised me how much fun I had. So I don't know. Who knows?
I'm curious. Did you hesitate when you were asked to take on the role of character 1?
Absolutely. Yes. I thought they were joking the first time they asked. I had a big laugh. And I asked if there was anyone else available, how they felt about it. And then Isabel was very sweet. You know, she pointed out that I do know the show. I've been with them through rehearsals. And and she was like, I heard you read when people were out during costume fittings or whatever. So I know that you have it within you to give an honest performance. And that's what we needed. So, you know, the show must go on.
And it sounds like you did a pretty amazing job, because looking at Naka here on our Zoom recording, she has like a big smile. And the moment you started talking about this, she had a big smile on her face, which tells me that everything worked out quite well, even though you might've had that initial hesitation.
She saved the show. I shouldn't say that, but she definitely stepped in and stepped up, you know, when she was needed. And that's great. I really admire that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to return to the text for a second. This is by Rachel Gratton. So we're dealing with a sexual assault and someone who, a young woman who's eager to fight back and not kind of let this pass in her life and move on. Like, she's eager to take a stand and to take action, but she's dealing with problems with her memory. Some things aren't quite fitting together. What do you think Rochelle was thinking about when she crafted this character, and how we as an audience kind of like how we're meant to relate to her, because she's kind of got these gaps, but she wants to really kind of stay true to who she is and what she's been through?
I really feel like the text deals with this kind of situation very organically. I think that everyone that goes through trauma of this kind, you know, it's not black and white. It's not, there's not concrete steps to take or a prescribed reaction to have. I think the character's challenges with memory are just as much influenced by society's opinions and the information that they're getting externally as much as it does with the emotional trauma and healing that is occurring, you know, kind of live time as we're going through this story. Even upon first read, it felt very real and very right. It honors, I think, a lot of the process of what this kind of trauma can take people through.
There's always the idea of like the unreliable narrator. And so the trauma itself, we can see in the text, kind of creates the environment for unreliable narration. And so that relates to the justice system and the society that we live in.
Yeah, there's so many roadblocks to, you know, pursuing and getting justice for yourself when you've gone through an experience like this. And that is, I think, why the unreliable narrator becomes this touchstone of like putting together what's happened to you. And I as you said, Birdie, I think when you have any kind of traumatic experience, as you were saying, like, you have to put stuff together. You don't remember in a linear way. Your experience may not be quite as you even remember it. Like, our memories are faulty, but getting to see the story through witnesses, through the police side of things, through friends, she's looking at this kind of as a collective experience and not just the story of the main character, which I think is fascinating.
Absolutely. I think, especially at the beginning of the play, you know, there is a linear sense in the sense that at the beginning, there's much more bystander information. There's much more sort of that unreliable narrator is much more present. And then as we sort of move through the different scenes and stages, I think the survivor's voice becomes a little bit more clear, and we start to narrow down some of the details. And then also, as you mentioned, you know, it's written as a collective experience. And so there's no real one version of the story that we ever land on, because we know that this is encompassing many stories at the same time. Yeah.
And the audience kind of has to be comfortable with not having the definitive answer, the definitive story.
Absolutely. Which I know is frustrating and freeing at the same time, if you can embrace it.
But also hues very much to real life, where we don't get, you know, the conclusion wrapped up with a neat little bow.
Absolutely, yeah.
Naka and Birdie, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time, and congratulations. We could say good luck. We don't have to say good luck, because it's already like in the can and it's going to be viewable as of tonight. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Sarah.
That was Naka Bertrand and Birdie Gregor, both performing in Night from the 4th to the 5th, launching in just under an hour from now. It's available on YouTube until May 29th at midnight. It's Pay What You Can. For more information on Rachel Gratton's show, as well as the team behind it, you can visit talisman-theater.com. They specialize in presenting English language translations of French plays and plays written in Quebec. I'm Sarah Day, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. More and more artists are trying to figure out how to create and present art while not doing harm to the planet. Sometimes a major undertaking, when you factor in the props, sets, costumes, the printing paper for scripts, the paperwork, paper for tickets as well. A new tool launched on Earth Day last month that promises to make the journey a little easier. The Creative Green Tools Canada program was developed over the past 2 years. It presents a system to help arts and culture organizations track their environmental impact and offers tips and support to reduce their footprint. The Quebec Drama Federation began working on this project with the Centre for Sustainable Practice in the Arts and the Conseil Québécois des Événements Éco-Responsables. As you're about to hear, they adapted a framework already in existence in the UK, but wanted to make it work for a Canadian context. The development of the program was done in consultation with an Indigenous advisory group, and it was funded with $500,000 in support from the Canada Council for the Arts and Canadian Heritage. Montrealer Devin Hardy is the program director, and she has had a huge hand in getting this project to ground. I spoke with Devin last month ahead of the big launch on Earth Day.
Welcome to Upstage, Devin. So lovely to have you here.
Nice to be here, Sarah. Thank you.
So tell me, what is Julie's Bicycle's Creative Green Tools? Let's start there.
The Creative Green Tools are a set of carbon calculation reporting tools that were developed specifically for the arts and culture sector. And they were developed by a UK-based charity called Julie's Bicycle, who exist to promote environmental sustainability within the creative industries in the UK. And basically, they've been working on this for over a decade. They started building the Creative Green Tools in 2009, and they've basically been developed and co-created and improved based on feedback from the sector ever since. And so what's resulted is like a really good, useful, simple, accessible online platform. And so we wanted to adapt those tools to the Canadian context.
So when you talk about adapting from a UK context to a Canadian context, what does that entail? Is that like little small things like changing not the spelling in the Canadian context, but like changing like a unit measurement, for example, or is it more like localizing it to concepts that we use in Canada as opposed to what you might use in the UK?
Well, so there's a lot of things. Yes, we do have to change the spelling of some words, but there's a lot more than that. And, you know, we did have to change all of, like, for example, the back end carbon emission factors to be more relevant to Canada. But there was also a lot of cultural consultation that we had to do in order to get them ready for the local context. So during this project, when it started and we got our first round of funding in April 2020, we started the adaptation process, and the first year was just research and consultation. So we spent a year just talking to folks in the arts and culture sector across Canada, and doing some user testing and doing research. And that basically gave us an idea of, A, whether or not it was even feasible or wanted or needed to bring these tools here. And then if we were going to bring the tools here, what would need to be adapted? We got a lot of responses during that consultation period that kind of made us go in directions that we didn't even realize we were going to go in. And so, you know, for example, like during the early consultation process, we were consulting with some Indigenous-led organizations, and they started bringing up really crucial themes like Indigenous data sovereignty and language and culture. And we felt that that deserved so much more understanding and development. So we hired an Indigenous-led consultant called Nahewin, and they basically ran a national engagement strategy to talk to Indigenous artists, Indigenous-led organizations, knowledge keepers all across the country, and kind of help us pull some of those threads and understand some of those issues and how we could adapt our platform and our programming to be inclusive, but also be enriched by Indigenous knowledge systems.
I'm speaking with Devin Hardy about the Creative Green Tools, which is about to launch, and she's been working on it for quite a while now. Did you come on board from the very first part of the consultation. You were describing that first year of having to check in with different people to get feedback. And you've been part of that since the beginning, right?
The conversation about this kind of predated my involvement. Julie's Bicycle has been longtime partners with the Center for Sustainable Practice in the Arts, which is the organization that now employs me. But, you know, they had been speaking for many, many years about what if we brought the tools to Canada? What if we brought the tools to Canada? And it had just, there had never been quite enough momentum or support from the sector or funding to be able to do that. But when I started working in this kind of very particular niche between arts and environment in 2019, I was speaking to Ian Garrett, who's the director of the CSPA, and we decided that we were going to try again to start this process. So I talked to lots of partners, and we got a sector innovation and development grant together for the Canada Council for the Arts, and it started from there.
So when we talk about tracking, understanding, reducing environmental impacts using these tools, what are we talking about specifically?
So the things that the tools track are a whole bunch of different emission sources and environmental impacts. So they take into account energy use, water use, waste, travel, and that's, you know, the travel of organizations, including employees and artists, but also the audience travel, which is very often the largest emission source in arts and culture, or at least in the performing arts. It also takes into account materials, lighting, a few other things.
And something like your audience coming to see you, tracking that, how would you begin to do that? Are you like asking people questions as they take their, buy their tickets, like ask them where they're coming from, if they're driving?
Yeah, so we're kind of like, we're trying to encourage those practices. Basically we ask organizations to put into the tool the modal splits of their audience. So that means approximately what percentage of your audience comes by this mode of transportation and what is the average distance traveled. And so we want to encourage organizations to survey their audiences or collect that information during the ticket sale process. And then they can plug it into the tools, and the tools do a calculation based on your total audience for either the year or the period that footprint is tracking.
What other things would you be tracking? You mentioned materials. So I guess I'm thinking of props and costumes. You mentioned lighting. Like, how would that get broken down into materials being used or emissions being created?
Well, I think to answer that question, I'll, I guess, give you a little bit of an idea of the types of footprints that the tools can create. So basically, it's broken down into like two rough groups, which is building footprints and project footprints. And so, you know, organizations that operate a building year round would create a building footprint that would include the utilities in their building and also some other impacts. But as we know, a lot of arts and culture organizations don't have a building. They might not even operate year round. They might have, you know, a festival during 1 month of the year, or they might have one production that they do. So the way that the tools have adapted to being better suited for the arts and culture for the arts and culture sector is to have those project footprints. And so, you know, we have different kinds of project footprints for different kinds of activities. So for example, you can track a tour, you can track a production, and it's in that production footprint that we look at things like set materials and lighting as well. So that footprint is actually a really great tool It can be used after a show to calculate the carbon footprint of that show in the past, but it's also a really great decision-making tool for designers, because what, you know, set designers or lighting designers can do, they can upload the types and amounts of materials that they're planning on using for a site or for a lighting rig. And they can see what that impact is, and then they can create different scenarios and adjust it. It's a really cool tool. I'm interested in seeing how folks put that to use in the best way.
And is there like a, you know, I think of someone who might take a commercial flight to go on vacation and then buy a carbon offset or plant a tree, for example. Is that part of the equation as well, that you might be told you've used, for example, X amount of energy or this amount of material, you would now buy a tree, plant a tree, or buy a carbon offset? Is that part of the calculus?
So it's not, carbon offsetting is not part of our platform. I mean, with every footprint, you're going to get your, you know, you're going to see your total CO2 equivalent that was created during that process. And you are, you know, you are able to go and then purchase carbon offsets from a retailer to offset your production. But no, it's not something that we take into account. We don't want to, carbon offsetting
it's a bit controversial.
It is, yeah. And I think it's important to understand that if, you know, you are really looking at your practices and your impacts, and you are, you know, reducing emissions wherever possible, and you're doing your best, and you still have a carbon footprint, which, I mean, obviously you will, nobody has no carbon footprint, that then, you know, if you would like to buy from a reputable offsetting company, you can, that's, you know, an option. But we don't want to encourage folks to just use offsetting as a crutch, I guess. It's an imperfect system. You're still putting those emissions into the air, and we don't have time as a planet to be just kind of polluting, and then paying into a project whose positive impacts aren't going to be realized for a long time.
Yeah, the tools are help you to, you know, as you move along, be more aware of what you're doing and how you can reduce through the process, not just tabulating it at the end, like doing your taxes and realizing how much money you're going to get back, for example, or how much money you still owe. That is the voice of Devin Hardy, and we're talking about the Creative Green Tools, which is launching tomorrow. And we speak with her within the context of the Center for Sustainable Practice in the Arts, which is helping to develop this for a Canadian context. We talked about audiences and how they get to the venues, and that's all kind of part of the calculation. Something else that occurs to me, something very hand-on literally, is buying your tickets. Does this encourage, for example, companies to move away from paper tickets?
So we don't actually have any carbon metrics for the actual printing of the tickets. So, I mean, if you do move away from paper tickets, it's not going to affect your measured carbon footprint in the tools. However, like, we do still encourage organizations to use practices that, even if they don't affect like the measured carbon footprint on our platform, are still beneficial. Like, we have there's a section in the tools called Beyond Carbon, which was developed to recognize actions that folks are taking that are important, but that might not, you know, that, for example, doesn't directly reduce your energy use. And like those, we have a series of questions, and they range from everything from like everyday best practices with your, you know, water use, waste, food, your practices on your site, Indigenous sovereignty, digital carbon footprint, governance, divestment, there's like loads of different things in that.
you are listening to see, I can see it. CKUD in Montreal.
Good evening and welcome to the May 12th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show we have a lecture entitled The Future of Work. It was recorded in Eugene, Oregon on March 30th of this year, and it's a lecture by Sarita Gupta. She's known for her policy advocacy, organizing and building partnerships across the workers' rights and care movements. As vice president of the Ford Foundation, she oversees all U.S. programs. Previously, she served as the executive director of Jobs with Justice and co-director of Caring Across Generations. She is author of The Future We Need, Organizing for a Better Democracy in the 21st Century. So here's tonight's lecture on Grey Matters, The Future of Work by Sarita Gupta.
There's endless stories that I've been hearing, especially of workers in the heartland who talk about how betrayed they feel, how left behind they feel. And this speaks to why we not only need to make work work, because we believe that all people should be able to work, live, and age with dignity, but why it's also important for people to have a voice and agency in all aspects of their lives, because this is what makes for a better democracy.